Presidential election years frequently feature ballots packed with lots of races and measures, and this one may actually be a bit above average. In addition to candidates from city council on up to president, we've got all those local ballot measures, which in much of this region are largely about marijuana and taxes. We'll focus up the ballot just a bit on races for the U.S. House. You notice how once people get elected to that body, they tend to stick around a while. Our first guest today is one of many to point out that that's no accident. David Daley wrote the book we call Rat Finked, because it's R-A-T-F, asterisk, asterisk, K-E-D, about how one party got control over drawing most of the congressional districts in this country. He's back with some general views on this election day and Congress. David Daley is the former editor-in-chief of Salon. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for having me back.
You bet. Good to have you here. So, you know, essentially then, to recap, the last two elections for House members are the results of efforts after the 2010 census. What happened there?
Yes. It's always good to start with a little bit of schoolhouse rock. We redraw all of these lines. All of our state legislative and congressional districts get redrawn every 10 years because of the census to account for population shifts or what have you. We've been doing this since the beginning of the Republic itself. However, the politicians really, really like this process because it allows them to draw the lines that they run on for the next 10 years. This is called gerrymandering. And in 2010, the Republican Party comes up with a brilliant plan to use specific micro-targeting of state house elections along with new mapping technology to reinvent gerrymandering as a really impressive partisan weapon to give themselves control of the Congress for the next 10 years. This is why in 2012, the first election run on the new maps, Democrats get 1.4 million more votes than Republicans, but Republicans keep control of the chamber. And this is why tonight, even though Hillary Clinton is widely expected to win a fairly big election in the Electoral College, it's why Democrats have a slight majority in the U.S. Senate, but there's not a single political analyst out there who believes that the Democrats have a chance of taking back the House, even though, again, they will get more votes.
Well, you know, I was listening to a bit of a discussion on Morning Edition on the way into work, and somebody had said that there might be 40 competitive House races out of 435.
Yeah, maybe.
So why so few competitive, though?
Well, because the districts are drawn so that they are not competitive. The politicians who have the power to draw these lines want to do this in such a way as to maximize the number of seats that they will get. They don't like competitive elections. They are confusing. They do not assure that they will win. And perhaps most importantly, they are really, really expensive for these parties to compete in. So if you can draw districts to no longer be competitive, you not only give your side the advantage, you can save a lot of money. Back in 2010, there were considered to be 70 competitive districts by NPR. In the 2010 congressional elections, Republicans won the power to redraw 47 of those 70 seats. They took them essentially off of the table. And this was part of their strategy. This was part of the strategy that they presented to their donors. They told donors, listen, you've paid $110 million in the last 8 years to help us win in these competitive seats. If you contribute $30 million to this plan we have in 2010, we will take those districts off the table for the next decade. We won't have to come back to you and ask for more money.
David Daley again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of Rat Finked, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. We had him on a couple of months ago. We wanted to have him back on Election Day to talk about how uncompetitive races for the U.S. House can be. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. When you look, though, I mean, to get into more of the schoolhouse rock, I mean, actually, this involved victories in state legislatures, didn't it?
Yes, exactly. This is where it all begins. In 41 of the 50 states, including Oregon, state legislatures play the primary role in drawing not only state lines, but also congressional lines. There's a handful of states like California that use a nonpartisan commission, and we can talk about that. That is often a better path, but although not always. And what the Republicans so craftily and brilliantly realized is that if they could target control of state houses across the country, if they could try to tip legislative chambers, they could have the only voice in the room when it came time to draw the new districts in the following year. So they studied the law in all of these 41 states, and they tried to be sure that they controlled every single aspect. So if in a state like Pennsylvania or North Carolina, the state house and the governor and the state senate, most simple, that they wanted to have all three of those pieces so that the other side could not have any influence on the process. And this works brilliantly because the Democrats, for one, aren't expecting it, because nobody had thought to use gerrymandering in precisely this way before. It's a complete paradigm shift. But it also didn't take much. By targeting less than 110 state house seats across the country, that represented the balance of power in 18 legislative chambers, and that gave the Republicans the power to draw 193 of the 435 congressional districts completely on their own. So that little bit has a huge influence, and a state house race, it doesn't cost that much. You can pull this entire thing off for pennies on the dollar. It's the greatest political bargain and greatest political heist, perhaps, of this century.
David Daley, did the stars align, though, for the Republicans to capture all those legislatures in 2010 in a particular set of circumstances that might not repeat? I mean, we're talking about the year of the Tea Party and all the anger mm-hmm. over Obamacare passage, et cetera, et cetera.
They had the perfect year for it. The wind was already at their back. So the fact that they also had a specific strategy really, really helped. I mean, Republicans had a big year in 2010. If you're going to have a big electoral wave, all the better to have it in a zero year, because that's the census year, and those elections often mean more. The Democrats, as we all know, Democrats don't particularly turn out in midterm elections, and also the midterm elections tend to be bad for the party that is in power nationally. So just about everything that could go wrong for the Democrats in 2010 did. But the Republicans were also better prepared with a brand new inventive strategy that the Democrats could not play defense against. And essentially, I don't think they really saw it coming or understood exactly what it would mean.
David Daley, our Election Day guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the former editor-in-chief of Salon, and he wrote the book that we call Rat Finked, that is subtitled The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. It's about the maneuvers that went on to set up new congressional districts based on the 2010 census by gaining control of the redistricting process through winning state legislatures in that same 2010 election. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this at 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Ann and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. I've watched politics ever since 1948, when I was 6 years old. And what I have seen is a extreme deterioration of the Republican Party to the point where they no longer do anything for anybody except the ultra-rich. And I contend that if it weren't for racism, sexism, gerrymandering, and voter suppression, that the Republicans would never, ever win another election in my lifetime. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann. Appreciate that. David, thoughts on that? I bet you've heard that before.
I have. I think Ann makes a terrific point. What you are going to see tonight is many hundreds of thousands more votes for Democratic House of Representatives candidates than Republicans, but Republicans are going to hold on to the chamber.
All right, so you think it'll be an aggregate victory?
Because they
in
have
votes?
It rigged. Mm-hmm. Yes, and this gerrymandering problem exists all the way down to the state level. Many of these state houses are rigged. So there are 14 states this cycle with new restrictions on voting, and there are 22 states with new restrictions on voting since the last presidential election. And 20 or 21 of those states are completely controlled by the Republican Party. So it's simply, when you step back from it, it does look like a very clear strategy. You redraw lines in your favor, and once you have control of these chambers, you pass laws that give yourself even a bigger advantage at the ballot box. On a day like today, when we are going out and practicing this sacred civic trust, the idea that one of the two parties believes that they can win largely through either suppressing the vote or redrawing the vote in more favorable ways to themselves certainly suggests to me that they ought to go out and take a basic civics class.
The idea of one party, though, getting more votes in the aggregate for mm-hmm. House races and yet getting fewer seats as a result of those races, I have to believe that is not something unique to our time.
Well, it is certainly unique when you look at this a big picture. There are only a handful of years. Certainly, we do not elect the House of Representatives by an aggregate popular vote. Mm-hmm. We elected by district. But there's only a handful of years in the last 120 or so that you can go back and look at this that the winner of the most votes has not also taken the greatest number of seats. And what we're about to see now actually is wholly unprecedented in modern American history, in that for the second consecutive a presidential cycle, the party with fewer votes is going to hold more seats. And this is new, and I think it's dangerous. When you look at it at the state level, it is all the more shocking. A state like Michigan, where there's 240,000 more votes for Democratic candidates in 2012, but a 9-5 Republican the majority, a state like Pennsylvania, where there's 100,000 more votes for Democratic candidates, but a 13-5 Republican majority. This is a way to thwart the will of the majority, and the House of Representatives, after all, is supposed to be the chamber that is most directly connected to the people and to the popular will. It's not supposed to be insulated from the ballot box, and that's what the drawing of these district lines have done. It's insulated our politicians from repercussions at the ballot box.
Let me get two thoughts here. Mm-hmm. Your idea of how district lines should be drawn and what the law says about contiguity or anything like that.
Yeah, you know, there are lots and lots of ways of looking at this, and every state, you know, does it a little bit differently. I mean, essentially, these districts have to be equal as far as number of population, and you want to keep communities of interest together. You want them to be as contiguous and compact as they can be, and I think we should want them to be competitive, because when we have competitive elections, we have the kind of robust public dialogue that we ought to have on issues. The problem with only having, you know, 30 or 40 congressional districts that are competitive out of 435 is that the only election that matters in these districts is the primary. And the primaries, as we all know, you know, tend to be battles that, you know, take place within the extreme of either party's base. And that's not healthy, especially when the only way that you can usually lose a party primary these days, if you're an incumbent, is if you are too willing to compromise, if you are too willing to work with the other side. I think we ought to be trying to find ways to encourage that rather than discourage it.
So the process itself, you're saying, produces polarization?
Yes, it does. The process itself produces polarization, it produces gridlock, and it's baked right into the process at the level at which we draw the lines. We have to understand that there is a basic connection right now between the way we draw these district lines and our polarized, broken, dysfunctional politics, and that until we can get a handle and find a way to fix this and draw the extremism back out, we are not going to get the kind of policy actions that a broad center of America would like to see.
David Daley, our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll take a few more minutes talking about congressional districts and why, in his opinion, this will be a lot like 2012 when there were more aggregate votes for members of the House, and yet for Democrats, and then more Republicans ended up getting elected to the U.S. House. 800-838-3760 by phone, email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Derek in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm trying to wrap my head around something here. Because if the Republicans were able to do this with, quote, the wind at their back and the Tea Party movement of 2010, I guess I just don't see a path for a return to the norm or more fair setup when the Democrats always are running rightward with them. For instance, we had a populist, self-described Democratic socialist that was drawing an amazing amount of support from the left and as well as the right because of his populism. And so I wonder, that just seems squandered, and I feel like the Democrats will always continue to squander this. After all, they were the people that couldn't think up of this plan to begin with. I'd like your response.
All right. Thanks for that, Derek.
I think there's a lot of wisdom there. Yeah, I think that's right. The Democrats not only didn't see this coming, but they simply, it's hard to see how they fix it and how they crawl out of it. What you're going to have tonight is probably a pretty big Democratic victory, but it's not going to budge the House. Most of the projections say that the Democrats will pick up between 13 and 15 seats tonight. They need 30 to take back the chamber. If they take back 13, they're going to be right back to the same 234, 201 that they were at in 2012 when Barack Obama was reelected. And what they have to do is find a way to win back state legislative chambers as well. And until they can really take this process seriously and focus on it, and until Democrats, you know, really start thinking about elections beyond the presidential level, this advantage is not going to go away. I mean, President Obama came out about a week or two ago and said that finding a path to sensible redistricting reform was going to be one of his top priorities after he leaves the White House. But the Democrats are already at a financial disadvantage in this race towards 2020. They are not going to have the element of surprise that the Republicans had in 2010, and they still have the hardest task of all, which is winning on these tilted maps. And so the Democrats, to me, look like they want to run the same play that the Republicans came up with in 2010, but it's not going to be as effective, and the Republicans have moved on. This plan was devised by the Republican State Leadership Committee, which was a really forward-thinking political action group based outside of D.C. And what they're working on now, in addition to being out there in 2020, they will certainly be out on the playing field, but they are working right now on taking back as many state secretaries of state offices as they can and coaching secretaries of state on how to word ballot initiatives in ways that favor conservative donors in the Republican Party. There was a terrific New York Times story on this over the weekend that I think got lost in all of the other election stories and the James Comey news over the weekend and everything else. But I would encourage people to go back and look at that. while the Democrats try to play catch-up, the Republicans are advancing the ball.
Just to finish up here, because obviously lots of stuff going on in this election, but you made the case recently that the redistricting process led to the kinds of presidential candidates that were produced, certainly on the Republican side, with Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that, I mean, certainly there have been so many factors that contributed to the rise of Donald Trump, but I do think that one of them is the way that we changed the tone and tenor of our politics after 2010 with the kinds of people we sent to Washington. It changed the mood within the Republican base. It soured people on the idea of compromise. They sent these people off who were going to say no, who were going to, you know, shut down the government over the debt ceiling, who were going to insist on multiple votes to repeal Obamacare, who were not particularly interested in working with the other side. And the mood of the base of the party really changed. And there were 17 Republicans who stepped up for the nomination. And the last two standing were Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. Two people not exactly known for compromise or their interest in dialogue with the other side. So it'll be interesting to see where things go after tonight.
All right, we'll keep an eye on the numbers tonight. Many numbers, obviously, but the idea of the aggregate vote for members of the House across the country versus the number of seats that each party gets will be an interesting comparison to make once again. David Daley is the former editor-in-chief at Salon and the author of Rat Fink, to what we're calling it, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. David, good to have you back on The Exchange.
Always a pleasure. Thanks again. Get out and vote, everybody.
All right. Take care.